Thank you. Be seated. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioners in the interest of BLD and BRD. Effective assistance of counsel in parental rights termination cases because the underlying right to counsel is merely statutory, not constitutional.
So if they appointed somebody who was completely incompetent, slept there at the trial, knew nothing about the law, completely botched the case, no question, and knew that going in, there's just no remedy for that.
First of all, Your Honor, I think there's two answers to that question. First is I think the court could expect and should expect that trial courts, when faced with that situation, will take action because they have a different role in these kind of cases than they do in the run-of-the-mill civil case. They have an interest in preserving justice and making sure that justice is done. I think, secondly, the U.S. Supreme Court has confirmed in several holdings, starting with Matthews v. Eldridge, the due process analysis.
We're not talking about due process. What did the legislature mean? When the legislature said you must appoint counsel, surely they didn't mean incompetent.
Clearly, and presumably they did not, Your Honor. However, the legislature also presumably did not intend to allow for claims of ineffective assistance of counsel to be raised on appeal, because that is so antithetical to the state's strong and vital interest in these cases in ensuring finality and getting these cases resolved during this critical period of development in the children's lives. And so I don't think that the court can or should assume that the legislature intended to bring a constitutional right of effective assistance of counsel when only granted a statutory right.
Well, suppose we agree with you that because the statute doesn't give rise to a constitutional right, but we've got to also construe that statute meaningfully. And would it be fair to say that the legislature contemplated that a trial court could appoint incompetent counsel?
I think, Your Honor, again, I'll go back to the notion that the trial court should take action on its own to prevent counsel, incompetent counsel in a rare situation.
Well, but you're not going to. Here's the problem in this case is he didn't file a motion for new trial. So the judge isn't going to call you up and say, don't you want to file a motion for new trial?
But, Your Honor, that gets into the kind of situation where you're talking about the waivers and getting to appellate review. Normally, in the context, you know that ineffective assistance claims can't be raised on direct appeal because it's not in the record. If the court does extend that right in these cases, then presumably parents are going to claim that they have a similar right to habeas, some kind of collateral proceeding you wish to raise. Of counsel claims. There's also a statutory right to counsel on appeal determination cases. If the court were to grant the Dawson argument and hold that there's a constitutional right or emanating out of that statutory right, then the same argument is going to be made about the statute on appeal granting the right to counsel. And then we're going to argue, well, after the appeal is done, my counsel in the appellate system was ineffective, and that's just going to drag this on and on and on. It's like what Justice Rehnquist said in his opinion in Evans. It's like a mirror held up to a mirror, this endless system of review and review upon review. Or the Court of Appeals, I'm sorry, the Court of Criminal Appeals in Texas in Ex Parte Graves compared it to a perpetual motion machine. When they found that the statutory right, U.S. Supreme Court Justice Owen, the statutory right to competent counsel in certain habeas proceedings does not include the right to effective assistance.
Isn't there some ground in there for saying that it's one thing to say, not every mistake will be incompetent, but isn't there some room in there to say that if there's truly just gross incompetence, that's not what the legislature contemplated?
I would agree with Your Honor that that is not what the legislature intended. However, the court still must come at the end to decide whether the legislature intended for parents to be able to raise claims of ineffective assistance. And because inherent in that notion is the idea that there has to be some kind of, I think, collateral procedure established similar to a habeas proceeding that the legislature has not seen fit to include, and it would be contradictory to, again, the state's strong interest in finality and what the legislature has prescribed in terms of the fast appellate review, the preference on appeals for termination cases, and the idea of incorporating the ability to claim ineffective assistance.
I understand that ineffective assistance of counsel arose under the habeas corpus kind of practice that was out there, but ineffective assistance of counsel didn't necessarily require an ancillary deal, couldn't ineffective assistance of counsel just be a euphemism for saying we're going to review the trial court's conduct, or we're going to review what happened in the trial court even if the error wasn't preserved? Isn't that really what ineffective assistance of counsel is? We're just going to say we, you know, this is our way of being able to look at what happened in the trial court even though error hadn't been preserved.
Let me clarify the department's position, Your Honor. We're not saying in this case that they didn't intend or that they, I'll be back up a minute here, lost my train of thought. In terms of the issue of whether there has to be a collateral review, if the court finds that there is a right to review for ineffective assistance claims, I'm not saying that that review necessarily has to be in a due process or in a habeas context where that it can only arise there. My point, however, is that the court extends that right, and naturally the parents are going to claim, if we have a right, then we have an ability to show that there's been a violation of that right or an intent to make an evidentiary showing, and we know from the criminal context that that is usually not apparent on the face of the record, and that's the reason that it's usually raised in habeas proceedings in the criminal context. And there's no reason to think the experience would be any different in the civil context.
Why did the legislature require appointment of counsel in the termination of parent-child relationship proceedings? Isn't it because it's something special or something important? Would you agree that this relationship, parent-child relationship, rises to constitutional proportions and is a fundamental interest?
Absolutely, Your Honor. The Department recognizes that.
Shouldn't it be protected by procedures that are correspondingly past constitutional muster?
Yes, Your Honor, it should.
But that does not, in your opinion, include effective counsel.
No, because there's two points on that. First of all, the due process test is fundamental fairness. We know that from this court's opinion in JFC and the U.S. Supreme Court's opinion in Lassiter. And if the court were to look at and consider, can the state provide a statutory right to counsel without providing the ability to review claims of ineffective assistance of counsel, is that fundamentally unfair? The answer is no. And the reason for that is the state has such a strong and vital interest in the finality of these cases that goes far beyond the state's interest at issue in Lassiter, and simply, and there, in that case, it was just its financial interest in not providing statutorily appointed counsel. Here, the state has voluntarily undertaken that burden. It's not a financial interest. The state's interest here is finality. And the idea of incorporating ineffective assistance claim on appeal or in some kind of collateral process is simply antithetical to that strong interest.
Are there any other states that have such a statute that have not recognized an effectiveness of counsel, ineffective assistance of counsel claim?
Your Honor, from my research and from what I'm aware of, there are a number of states that have looked at their own state statutory right to counsel and concluded summarily that a statutory right to counsel includes a right of effective assistance.
So if we were to decide it does not, we would be out there by ourselves.
I believe that's correct. However, I think if Your Honor looks at the cases, there's really not much analysis on that point, and those decisions ignore the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Coleman v. Thompson and Pennsylvania v. Finley, which stand for the very important proposition that the state may well provide statutory appointed counsel when it's not constitutionally required to do so without providing the full panoply of constitutional rights that would have to accompany the constitutional right.
Again, we can totally agree with you that there's not a constitutional right, but we still have the statute in front of us where the legislature intended for parents to have counsel.
And they did have counsel in this case, Your Honor, and indeed the record clearly reflects that they had very effective counsel. They had vigorous and zealous advocacy on the part of their child.
But your argument is we shouldn't look at whether they're effective or not. But you seem to be conceding then that the legislature did have some level of confidence in mind when they required counsel.
Again, simply the fact that the legislature may have intended that does not mean that the legislature also intended there for there to be appellate review of whether there was ineffective assistance. And the Court of Criminal Appeals in Ex parte Gray considered that exact question, whether the statutory right, in that case, to competent counsel, gave rise to ineffective assistance review, and that the court concluded no, it wouldn't in that case because it would lead to that sort of endless process, which again would be implicated in this case because there was also a statutory right to appoint counsel on appeal. And the court, I think, would have to address that question of if there's a right to bring ineffective assistance claims based on the trial right to counsel, then parents are going to argue for the same thing on appeal. And where does that claim get raised? And how does that get considered? And what does that mean to the children in these proceedings who are already being subject?
Under JFC, the court did not address the ineffective assistance of counsel by going ahead and addressing all the points of error to begin with and determining that there wasn't any reversible error there. could the court in a juvenile case always avoid having to decide whether ineffective assistance of counsel is a viable point by simply looking at the error that's alleged to have occurred in the trial court, determining that there's no error, reversible error there, and therefore never reach the question of ineffective assistance of counsel? As an example, in this case, if they just look to the failure to file a motion for new trial with factual sufficiency, is that what's the...
I'm not sure. I think I may have confused the court. There may have been some confusion that arose here. The only question as to the effectiveness of counsel arose from an alleged conflict of interest.
Oh, the conflict of interest, these two cases where the husband and wife were tried together.
Yes.
And the error was there. It was presented to the court. And can't the court just look and see if there was a conflict and whether or not it should have been tried separately and without ever deciding that there was ineffective assistance of counsel?
Well, certainly, Your Honor, a number of courts of appeals have done that and said we don't decide the issue, but we're going to look and find in the facts of this case that assistance was not ineffective. Number one, I think that just is going to put off that question until another day. Eventually, the court is going to have to reach the question of whether if there is a right that is claimed by the parents in this case, if that right does exist, and if it emanates from the statutory right, then it's going to have to consider the difficult questions of where do you raise it if it's not reflected in the trial transcript? Do they get an opportunity to show that? And the argument is going to be made, it's a constitutional right, surely that there's a remedy, surely there's an opportunity for an evidentiary proceeding to establish it, judicial review, and all those things. So I'm not sure that Your Honor's question, I mean, I suppose the court could look at the facts in this case and conclude that there was no ineffective assistance, but I think it's going to have to address the issue.
Yes, she is.
Yes,
go ahead. You asked a question?
Well, I don't understand why we can't just say what we're reviewing here is a refusal to order severance, and we should review the refusal to order the severance under an abuse of discretion standard. And in applying the abuse of discretion standard, don't we look at the nature of a conflict, just like we would in any civil case, determine whether the trial court abused their discretion in not ordering separate trials? It's hard for me to see how we get into effectiveness.
I would absolutely agree, Your Honor. The only reason we got into effectiveness is because the Court of Appeals decided to mix in the criminal law standards into this civil case, which the Department contends was absolutely inappropriate. And we would agree with Your Honor that the real question here would be under the civil standards, both in the abuse of discretion, number one, whether we're entitled to affirmatively waive any conflict, which they clearly did, and under this court's holding and the court's appeals holdings, that conflicts of interest which come under the disciplinary rules can be waived.
Assuming, and I don't assume, and you don't apparently, that they waived this argument on conflict, because I think, if I'm not mistaken, they asked for separate trials rather than separate counsel.
Yes.
Assuming he preserved that, or we took a look at that, why do you argue that this is not a conflict of interest with him representing these two people?
First of all, I would go to what Justice O'Neill pointed there. That would only be under the criminal law standard that you would get to that issue. If it's under the civil law standard, then they can and did affirmatively waive any conflict of interest. I'm assuming they couldn't waive it as the Court of Appeals said. The Department would argue there is no conflict of interest here because of the nature of the statutory grounds for termination that were submitted. The Court of Appeals erroneously assumed that particularly conduct on the part of the father, affirmative kinds of bad acts that endangered the children, had no bearing on the culpability of the mother on the statutory grounds. And that's simply not the case, because subsections D and E were both submitted. The fact that one parent was endangering the child through acts, the other parent was leaving the child with a person who was endangering, or leaving the child in conditions or surrounding that endangered that child. And so there wasn't a conflict in that sense. Their trial strategy, which may well have been the better trial strategy, was to say, we both, we're good parents, we didn't do this together, rather than be forced, as the Court of Appeals seems to hold, that they were forced to litigate against each other and have their counsel take the finger at each other and say, that's the bad
order. What's to prevent this happening as a part of trial strategy in every case, to have the lawyer part, the parents, to get up and say, Judge, and at the end of the trial, say, basically, I've got a conflict here. I was going to go argue for one, and I can't do it now. How do you, is that your strongest reason for saying that you can't, there's no conflict here?
Your Honor, my time has expired. I've got to answer your question. I think our firm's position would be three things. Number one, under the civil rules, they could affirmatively waive the conflict and did. And number two, even if you look under the criminal law standard and say that they couldn't have waived it, we would ask the court to look no farther than the Court of Criminal Appeals decision in James v. State, which is cited in the Court of Appeals opinion in this case. And that provides a good example of exactly why it was a totally reasonable trial strategy for the parents to decide to stay together and not fight each other, not litigate against each other. And that is something that could be raised in every case to sort of build in reversible error if the Dossier's position were adopted.
So I take it your answer to my question is just this has happened to be a criminal proceeding, it's a civil proceeding. I don't think that's what I was driving at. I'd appreciate if you, when you come back, you might want to address that a little bit more.
I apologize.
That's all right. I probably didn't ask it clearly. Thank you.
Well, Mr. Hughes, before you sit down, another question. You argue that in the civil context that the parties waived any possible conflict when they were on the stand under oath. Doesn't that put the cart before the horse? The statute requires that before court appoint one attorney to represent both parents, that it has a duty to find that there's no conflict. Is there any evidence in the record that the trial court complied with that duty?
Your Honor, I think there is evidence in the record, and I refer the court to volume 11, page 22 of the recorder's record, and that is the page on which trial counsel for the parents, before the parents actually testified and provided that under oath, trial counsel represented to the court that there was not a legal conflict of interest between the parents and represented to the trial court that their interests were substantially the same. And I think given those representations by trial counsel and given the U.S. Supreme Court's holding in Kyle v. Sullivan that trial courts are entitled to rely on what trial counsel says about conflicts because they're in the best position to know, I think the trial court can be found to have made an implied finding that there was not a conflict given trial counsel's representation.
However, at that point in time, their counsel was still relying on his argument, was he not, that there was a potential conflict that he saw and later argued that there was an actual conflict, didn't he?
That is correct, Your Honor, but I think even under the criminal law standard, merely the idea that there's a potential conflict is not enough for there to be a conflict of interest.
Wouldn't that at least trigger a hearing, maybe an evidentiary hearing, under this statutory duty by the trial court to make a finding that there is no conflict when the counsel specifically raises his concern that there's a potential conflict in this situation? We have no ruling on the record. You're asking us to assume that some ruling was made, some finding was made. Wouldn't the raising of a potential conflict by the attorney, in light of the statutory duty, trigger at least the trial court to make some findings on the record, in your opinion?
Your Honor, the department would submit that facts of this case did not require such an evidentiary hearing, given trial counsel's representation.
Well, evidentiary or not.
Or any kind, we would also argue that it would not require a specific finding, that that finding can be implied based on the trial court, the fact that he denied the request for separate trials, which was not, of course, the request for separate counsel. And we believe under these facts that that was not sufficient to trigger any kind of affirmative obligation that, as I understand, would only exist under criminal law standard anyway.
Other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
Thank you, court.
Good morning, Your Honors. And please, the court. I cite from the Supreme Court of the United States in MLB versus SLJ, when deprivation of parental status is at stake, however, counsel is sometimes part of the process that is due.
Can you walk me through how we get to the effectiveness of counsel?
Yes, Your Honor, I can. First off, we're not dealing with the Sixth Amendment right to counsel. We're dealing with the Fifth Amendment right to counsel. That case is potentially...
But I guess I'm following up on my earlier question. It seems to me what we're reviewing here is the trial court's refusal to order separate trials.
Yes, Your Honor.
And don't we look at that under an abuse of discretion?
Well, that's part of the analysis. But you have to look at it in the terms of a substantive due process right. Because the legislature, by enacting the statute, has codified what the Supreme Court said in Lassiter and MLB versus SLJ. That this is part of your due process right to have counsel.
Are you telling Justice O'Neill that it's impossible for you to win this case without this court deciding that there is some legally imposed right to effective assistance of counsel?
No. Okay. But I'm saying that is the higher and more important question that at some point in time this court is going to have to address.
Well, but we kind of follow the 100-year-old dictum that you don't decide constitutional issues just because they're laying around somewhere in the case. So can we start from the other direction and answer Justice O'Neill's question, and then if we have to show us the decision tree under which we have to get to this issue.
But, before you do that, it strikes me that we look at the refusal to grant the motion for separate trials, and in doing that you look at the conflict question.
Right.
And at what point, let's say the trial court, when it denied the motion at the beginning, didn't really see a conflict, the parties represented everything was okay. But if a conflict arises during the trial, what becomes the trial court's burden then to stop and order separate trials?
The answer is it has an absolute duty to, because sometimes there are conflicts that are not apparent and develop.
Well, and it happens in many contexts, okay. If that's true. But at what point can it be, is it waivable under the statute?
I don't believe it's waivable for several reasons. First off, you have an overlying question of Rule 107, Texas Dictionary Rules of Professional Conduct. When you have parties that are adverse to each other, it requires a written consent before disclosure, before the attorney can continue representing. That's not here.
But it's not immediately apparent that they're adverse to each other. It could be a matter of trial strategy to present a united front.
It is possible, and I would not deny that a very effective, crafty, sneaky attorney might try that. However, I think that would be readily apparent from the record. Here, the conflict, to me, is very apparent. You have an allegation against the father of pornography and theft. You have an allegation against the mother of burning of the foot.
How's the evidence going to be any different? They're separate trials. The same evidence is going to come in, because in the mother, in the trial, as the mother, it's all going to come in to say she knew this and she allowed her children and she continued to live with them, and vice versa.
Because it's very easy, Your Honor. All she has to do then is stand up and say, I didn't know anything about this. The fact that he was into child pornography, I believe that's a disputed question as to who had access to the computer and Ms. Fanning addressed that. She at least has the ability to stand up and say, I didn't know anything about it. And it does not damage her co-defendant, her husband, at the same trial. Because as shown by the affidavit from the juror, we thought they were going to get back together, and that's why we terminated her. That's the danger.
But that's still the danger if you have separate trials. I mean, I don't see how you eliminate that.
You're not presenting it in the same way. It allows her to get up and testify without prejudicing herself by the fact that her husband is sitting at her side.
But what if she consciously made a decision, I don't want the case tried that way. We want to present a united front.
I believe the court is using, or Her Honor is using, the wrong standard. It is not for the client to understand the fact that there's a conflict. It's for the attorney to make the full disclosure under the TDPRC. It's Rule 106, 107, 108, I believe 109. It's the attorney who has to get the written consent when they're adverse. And in this situation, you have allegations that are adverse. All she has to do is prove, I didn't know about the pornography or the theft. And she defeats one of their elements of placing the child with somebody who's endangering the child.
Let me ask you this. I just don't know how this works. If you have a couple and the rights are terminated as to one parent but not the other, and the couple's still together.
That is a realistic matter. It never happens for the very reason that juries look at it and say, well, they're going to get back together and we're going to terminate them both.
Well, if that's the case, then I don't understand the harm here.
The practical effect does not change the statutory and constitutional questions presented. The court had an obligation under Section 107, 016, I believe it is, 13, to determine whether there was or was not a conflict.
So in every case where a lawyer comes in and represents two sides, the court says, you better bring me up a written, signed conflicts agreement before we go to trial because I'll get reversed otherwise.
That's the duty under the TDPRC, yes, Your Honor, one or two, to have a hearing of some sort. It can be an affidavit or it can be evidentiary. What are the allegations? Why is there a potential conflict? The easy answer is appoint two attorneys. You don't have to have separate trials, just appoint two attorneys. I believe the request by Mr. Villarreal was actually inartful. He should have requested separate counsel. And that goes directly to the case of Holloway versus Arkansas that's cited in our brief. where you're representing three co-defendants. How do you pull one up and point the finger at the other ones?
Now, I'm going to take you off a little bit. Now, you say there's a constitutional right to effective assistance of counsel, right?
What they said was that appointment of counsel is part of the process that is due in some cases. Our legislature has recognized that and said, when you are indigent, you must be appointed counsel in termination cases.
Because of the constitutional interest at stake.
That is correct.
Would it apply to non-indigent parents as well?
If you have a conflict, since what we're dealing with are fundamental liberty interests, I believe the answer is going to be yes. You still cannot, it does not matter under Supreme Court authority whether you have appointed counsel or retained counsel, the duties are still the same. If you have a conflict that goes to the core of your ability to represent one party over the other, then that's impinging upon your fundamental rights to counsel.
Mr. Brett, just getting back to Judge O'Neill's question, walking us through how you get to ineffective assistance of counsel here. If I understood, you said you go, it's not a Sixth Amendment right, you go to the Fifth.
It's a Fifth Amendment right. Issue. It's a Fifth Amendment right. The case is Potashnik, P-O-T-A-S-H-N-I-C-K, versus Port City Construction Company. It's a Fifth Circuit case, 609 Federal 2nd, 1101. And I apologize, it's not cited in our brief. And it cites, I believe it's Powell versus Alabama, from the Supreme Court of the United States for that proposition. It doesn't stand for the proposition that you have a right to have counsel appointed in the civil case, but that what you're dealing with is the Fifth Amendment right to due process.
Well, doesn't that, in effect, the way that kicks in, and I could be wrong about it, but once a state has given a right that they didn't have before that, that you have to comply with due process to, in effect, remove that right?
Yes, Your Honors. That is the...
Explain to me how the Texas procedure does not allow, our system of justice does not allow under procedural due process to make up for this gap.
Well, if I understand His Honor's question, the procedure that is in place is 107.013 from the Family Code. The court has to make a determination whether there is or is not a conflict. All right? What we're dealing with here is the substantive due right to a conflict-free attorney. And here, that right was abrogated because the court relied upon, apparently, upon the waiver expressed from the witness stand by the Dossies. What you have are not experienced counsel for an insurance company, which is one of the cases that the state cites in their brief. What you have are two very unsophisticated people. How do they know what a conflict is?
Well, the system, though, once we back out the idea, and you say ineffective counsel equals no counsel?
That is correct.
Okay. So once you back that out, does Texas have a backstop system in any of its procedures to, in effect, protect the parents' rights?
Procedurally, no. And the only remedy is going to be is to afford a new trial with separate counsel.
Don't they have it through this, what you're doing here today?
Well, but partially, but where does that put them in the situation? If the court reverses, where do we go? Do we go back to a new trial, or is everything King's X? Well, the answer is no, it's not King's X, because res judicata does not apply, the state can bring a new proceeding, and so forth. So the fact that we were on the vespers of a deadline, counsel was appointed a month before the trial and recognized within 3 weeks that he had a potential conflict and brought it to the court's attention. All right? The state could have dismissed and refiled and got around the deadlines. So that there's no harm to the state there. The importance is what is at stake for the parents. And that's their liberty interest in that family unit.
Any other questions? Are you righteous? Yes, Ms. Fanning. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
May it please the court. In answer to your question, Judge Snyder, there may be a catch-all, and I don't believe that the 10th Court addressed it, but it's something that Judge Enoch had pointed out in an earlier case when there was a procedural glitch in a Dallas case, I believe, in Kresnicki, I believe is the name of the case, where at that time Rule 2 was not available to civil cases. At this time, Rule 2 is available to civil cases for a court of appeals to craft a remedy when there apparently is no remedy. And I believe that's maybe kind of where the 10th Court has worked its way into addressing, not only from a due process standpoint, but to remedy the problems with ineffective assistance of counsel or overlooked, unpreserved error. As I think Justice Enoch said, we're going to review this anyway. We're going to have a reporter's record. We're going to have a clerk's record. We're going to go through all the motions.
Does it require extrinsic evidence?
Well, in that case, there was just a failure to re-request a record or something, so there was no record for the court. It was on the record on that one.
But, I mean, do you contemplate that this might require extrinsic evidence?
Well, there's another case, I believe, that's going up in Dallas right now on Griffin, and their suggestion is if it's not available on the record, and I believe BLD is on the record as far as the problems that this one has. If it's not on the record, it's going to become apparent probably to the appellate attorney where error is not preserved. And when that happens, at that point, I believe the appellate attorney could request that the appellate court then have an evidentiary hearing, because at that point the record would be in front of the Court of Appeals, and they would be able to look at the record to see if there was effectiveness or whatever. If they did not,
so the answer is yes, it might require extrinsic.
It might require an evidentiary, but again, I believe that that's something that the Court of Appeals could possibly look at and have an evidentiary hearing at that point. I believe Rule 2 might give us some flexibility in a way to look at these unpreserved errors and afford due process that might otherwise just be swept under the rug. And I believe that was a question that you had earlier on JFC also. How do we get there from when error isn't preserved, what can we do? And maybe it's Rule 2 that kind of gives us a way to look at that and make sure that the due process that's needed in these situations is afforded to the parent. And I believe the 13th Court and the 14th Court, while they haven't said, yes, we believe that there should be effective assistance of counsel, they haven't gone that far, but they have said, we recognize that the first court, and now the second court and out of Fort Worth, and the 10th Court have all recognize there is a right, we're going to look at it and examine it. The standard in Strickland is so well established in criminal law that it's easy to transfer it to this kind of action.
What's the answer to petitioner's argument that this is going to build in even more delay into the processing of these cases?
Well, I would point out to the court that their emphasis on speed is exactly what got us where we are here today. Because when they forced this case to trial without adequate representation, because they just did not allow enough, and I believe the reason for Mr. Villarreal's offer of separate trials was that it was the most efficient, time-efficient way to do what the court needed to do in the time allowed. If he could try the cases back-to-back and take maybe 2 or 3 days each, then they probably could have fit it in between the 17th and the 27th of August, which was the time that was allowed. Appointing another attorney would be an additional delay, and it was very obvious through the record that the court was not going to delay it. They wanted to cram this case in by the deadline. And Santosky specifically addresses the fact that the most important issue is not speed, but accuracy. I believe the state is leading the court to believe through all these procedures that the child and the parents are adversaries.
Well, I'm still having a problem seeing how we get to the effective assistance claim. If we look at the trial court's actions under an abuse of discretion in denying the motion for separate trials.
Right.
In the typical civil context, there are situations where the representation's made that we don't think there's a conflict, one could develop, and there's sort of a wait-and-see attitude. If no conflict develops, the trial goes on. If a conflict becomes apparent during the trial, the trial court can then, at that point, order separate trials. I seem to be hearing you say that because a conflict could have been created, the trial court should have granted separate trials. Are you claiming that in this record a conflict ever arose during the trial itself?
Well, I believe it was a conflict any time. And the reason that the court refers to criminal cases, I believe, as far as instead of civil, is that civil cases are usually, you don't usually have a bunch of defendants using the same attorney. And that's usually a scenario that occurs, and it occurs fairly regularly in criminal trials, so that it's the due process that...
Well, we do have some, though. We have some conflicts where, for example, an attorney, there's a question as to whether they're conflicted out of a case, and it has arisen in connection with the trial that they seem to be using information they might have gotten through their prior improper representation. We've had cases like that. And I guess I'm trying to determine if we're looking for the trial court's abuse of discretion at the moment the motion's denied, and I think that was at several moments,
right,
don't we have to look and see what the evidence was before the trial court of a conflict?
I can't remember the citation, but I believe there is a case that says that once there is a conflict, the representation becomes ineffective.
Well, but
it's
so,
kind of an automatic process.
But under that analysis, it's going to require in every case parents to be tried separately, which I believe your co-counsel says is a bit of an anomaly because juries don't ever terminate as to one and not the other. So I'm coming around.
Well, as a practical matter, the solution that's been tried and has so far has worked in Waco is this has cured the one attorney for two parents issue.
So typically it's two attorneys in one trial.
Exactly.
Okay, if that's the real issue, then we still have to get to whether the trial court erred in not having two trials, because that's the only objection that was raised.
Well, and again, the purpose for that was the short time distance and the trial court being determined that it was going to get this done beforehand, and the two trials were the only way. It wasn't, as Mr. Brott said, it might have not been elegant, but so that was the... Their concern was time. He was attempting to present it to the court and be efficient at the same time. I'm not sure that answered your question.
Well, I think what I'm hearing you say is that the harm doesn't result from one trial. The harm results from one lawyer.
That's exactly correct.
But
because
if you don't,
he could not serve two masters.
Well, then why didn't you waive that? Because it was never requested that another counsel be appointed. It was only requested that they be tried, that unless they were tried separately, there would be a conflict or there'd be prejudice or there'd be harm.
Well, the problem is that the conflict was pointed out, and once that conflict raises its head, until there's a finding that there is no conflict, which there is not in this case, then you're going forward with a conflict in the representation, and that conflict then creates the ineffectiveness, almost per se, I believe. It's kind of one kind of leads to the other.
But in this case, the way it's presented procedurally,
correct,
we would have to say the trial court abused its discretion in not ordering separate trials because of an inherent conflict.
Well, and unless...
And that's where I'm having trouble.
I believe that's a good way to approach it. But again, it's not only an abuse of discretion procedurally, but it's also a substantive denial of due process because they are made to go forward in a case without counsel. If effectiveness of counsel is required and they don't have it and there's a conflict, and conflict equals ineffectiveness, then they have...
So, well, we're going to come out with one of two rules in this case, either if we follow your position. Either in every one of these cases, we have to have separate trials with the same counsel, or in every one of these cases, each parent has to get separate lawyers because there's always going to be presumptively competent.
Well, I don't believe that you're going to have the same counsel. If you had separate trials, I don't believe you'd be required to have separate counsel because he'd be able,
No, that's my question, though. We're going to have to come out of this with a rule that says either separate trials or separate counsel in every one of these cases because you're presuming harm at the outset.
Unless the court can make a finding, can examine it and through pretty vigorous
find no harm done
findings, right, that would sustain the scrutiny of Santosky that requires.
And what would the harm analysis look like here? I mean, it seems to me you've just said that trying them together, there's no harm.
Well, I believe that the court in the 10th court addresses the harm analysis in saying he could not serve two masters. And if that's the case, if you can't vigorously represent one client to the exclusion of another, then that's going to result in harm.
So it's presumed harm.
I believe that's correct, Your Honor.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court. I'd like to start back with Justice Schneider's question that I was doing a very bad job of answering before, and I just wanted to clarify the question. As I understood it, it was if a mere claim of a potential conflict is sufficient, is that going to lead to problems with reversible error being built in many trials? Is that Your Honor's question, or is it different?
No, it's just isn't there another reason other than this is a criminal matter, not a civil matter, or this is a civil matter, not a criminal matter? Isn't there some policy other than that when you make your distinctions here?
Well, I think this is somewhat different from the usual conflict of interest analysis in a run-of-the-mill civil case. But the department would also disagree that the criminal standards are applicable for some of the reasons I think that Justice O'Neill was articulating. Here, number one, because of the nature of the charge, it very well could have been in the parents' best interest to stand together at the termination trial. And that's something that's very different from criminal co-defendants in a criminal case. And even in a criminal case, the case I pointed out earlier, the James case from the Court of Criminal Appeals, I think is the most analogous if the court is going to look for the criminal jurisprudence, because that case involved two brothers who were co-defendants in a robbery trial. They had separate alibis. They both maintained their innocence. The jury found them guilty. And on appeal, the Court of Appeals found there was a potential conflict of interest. Each brother could have argued the evidence was worse than the other. The Court of Criminal Appeals rejected that argument. They said, first of all, we would have to assume that these brothers wanted to implicate each other in the robbery and accuse each other of what they called nefarious conduct. I think that's exactly analogous to this case, where it's saying the parents would have been forced to litigate against each other. And that's simply not a...
Let me ask you this. Would it be fair to say that the statute presumes that one counsel is okay for both? The presumption is one counsel for both together, unless a conflict is shown.
I think that would be fair, Your Honor, partially given the general rule in both civil and criminal law. There's many kinds of rights, even if they had a right to separate counsel, it can be waived.
Well,
and a presumption would work, I think, in a similar fashion.
Or let's say you presumed that you have to have separate counsel unless the trial court finds no conflict. I think that's probably more.
That's probably the way the statute is written.
And so if we start with the premise that separate counsel should have been appointed, and you're looking at whether the failure to appoint separate counsel was an abuse of discretion, we'd have to find that, in fact, there was an actual conflict or conflict developed in order for the trial court to have abused its discretion. Is that right?
That's correct. And the Dossie citation...
Not just a potential for one.
That's correct. And the Holloway case, Holloway v. Arkansas, doesn't apply because the mere potential for a conflict isn't enough to require the trial court to conduct an inquiry, even in the criminal law standard.
You expressed concern that the examination of the effectiveness of counsel on appeal would further delay these cases. What takes them so long to get to trial? It seems like we have a lot of cases that bump up against the one-year deadline.
I think, Your Honor, just looking at the facts of this case, oftentimes, in this case, for instance, it didn't start out after the one-year deadline started to run. The department's position initially was to try to reunite the children with their family. And as the clock is ticking, the department only to change its position determination later on because of the parents' continued conduct that showed that they were continuing to endanger the children and continuing to not be responsible parents. And so I think oftentimes it is because the department is trying its best to reunite them with the children as possible. Sorry, my time has expired. Can I just answer the question?
Yes.
And that's one of the reasons that the deadline oftentimes is.
Any other questions?
Thank you,
Counsel. That concludes the argument on the second clause. The court is pleased to welcome in our chambers today a number of judges and scholars and students from the Republic of Turkey. And we hope that there are enough of these little guides to the morning argument left that you can understand something about the argument that you just heard half of and the remaining argument we have today. We will now take a brief recess, and we will come back to hear the morning's final case.
All right.